This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Hi, it's Stephen Colbert, and I'm here to tell you about The Late Show Pod Show, which is the podcast of The Late Show with me, Stephen Colbert, and I'm here with my producer of the podcast, Becca. Hi, Becca.
Hi, Stephen.
So what do people get when they listen to The Late Show Pod Show? Let's sell this thing.
The extended moments, for sure, because we run out of time for broadcast, but we have plenty of time on the podcast.
It's kind of like being a live audience member of the show because you get things that no one else hears. Listen to The Late Show Pod Show with Stephen Colbert wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code Spotify for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
16 years from today, Greg Gerstner will finally land the perfect cannonball. Epic splash. Unsuspecting friends. A work of art only possible because Greg is already meeting all these same people at AARP volunteer and community events that keep him active and involved and help make sure his happiness lives as long as he does. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/local.
Hello and welcome to the Music to My Ears podcast, brought to you by BBC Music Magazine, the world's best-selling classical music magazine. This week, reviews editor Michael Beake sits down with the award-winning British film and television composer Debbie Wiseman. Debbie talks about writing music for the small screen, the pleasure she gets from listening to her friends play music, and the challenge of recording her latest film score during lockdown. There's even a sneak preview of a track from the score, which is for the forthcoming film, To Olivia.
Well, hello, Debbie.
Hello, Mike. It's great to see you.
You too. I will say good evening because it is the evening. Is the evening a normal working time for you, or do you like to shut up shop at a certain time of the day?
No, I often work in the evening, and I like working in the evening because it's quiet and I don't get so many emails and calls and distractions. So actually working in the evening is a really nice time for me. And I like it when it's dark. For some reason, I like working in the dark. There's something about the focus that you have in the evening. I used to be the other way around. I used to get up really, really early in the morning and work before anything. You know, so by about 9 o'clock, I'd done quite a lot of work and I felt quite smug. You know, when I got to sort of 10 o'clock, I'd achieved quite a lot. Most people hadn't even started their working day, so I would get up and feel really smug. But I've noticed over the past couple of years that's changed, and I prefer the evening now. But it varies, and it depends on what I'm working on, of course. The only problem with working in the evening is that I do find when I go to bed, the tunes are still going around my head. So I have to give myself at least an hour of wind-down time after I finish writing. Otherwise, it's impossible to get to sleep because I've got the tunes going around in my head.
Talk us through a little bit about your space that you work in, because I think it's nice to paint a picture for people to understand a composer's workspace and how it's all set up. So what have you got around you in there? What can people imagine seeing?
Well, the centrepiece, of course, is my grand piano, which is where everything happens and where I write and where I feel most comfortable. I'm just at the piano and I've got my manuscript paper and I've got my pencil. It's quite old-fashioned, really. It's nothing particularly high tech. It's my tools, you know. It's like, I suppose for a book writer, they have they either work at a computer or a typewriter if they've still got one of those old things, or maybe they even write by hand, some of them. But I still write by hand, so I sketch everything on manuscript paper and pencil, and then at that stage, because the technology is now available to us, around the piano, I have a big screen where I run the film or the TV show that I'm working on, and then I have a whole load of different samples of instruments, everything from woodwind, brass, percussion, strings, weird and wonderful electronic sounds that I might be using to create the score. And I start the orchestration. So once I've written it at the piano, I then decide who's going to play what. Is this going to be played on the flute or is this going to be played on the clarinet? And I start to orchestrate it, playing all the different instruments into my music software program, and slowly but surely build up the score. And that's what I play directors or whoever I'm writing for. I play them my, what is called a mock-up, my preview of the score. And they listen to that knowing that it'll be replaced by the real thing. But it's a very useful way of demonstrating what's going on musically.
Sure. And have you felt sort of any pressure over the years to sort of keep updating kit and be on top of like how all that stuff is changing?
Yeah, definitely. You have to, actually, Mike. You know, you can't be a dinosaur, much as I'd like to, you know, much as I'd love to just sort of sit here with my manuscript paper. It doesn't really work in today's world. Everybody wants to hear the music previewed before they go in the studio. And so, yes, you do have to keep up to date. And I'm constantly updating. I've got a Pro Tools set up, which is what's the sort of standard usage in the studio is Pro Tools, which I've also got here, which allows me to sync all the music to picture when I'm writing to picture. And I have, you know, a sophisticated software program. I'm not technical. Luckily, my husband Tony is, so he can sort of help me work it all, because I'm very untechnical, yeah. as you noticed when we were trying to set up this podcast.
I'm saying nothing. It was a very well-oiled machine.
It was smooth, wasn't it? Eventually. But, you know, generally, I sort of don't like the technology to get in the way of the composition. And I think the danger is when it takes over your composing life. I like the piano, because that's my instrument, to be the centerpiece. And then it's the manuscript paper that's my centerpiece, because that's what I'm writing on. And I can hear most of it in my head. I just try it out at the piano, make sure I like it. And that's the composing process.
And talk about the piano there being the center, and the piano has obviously been something that you've been passionate about since you were very, very young. In terms of recorded music when you were young, was there something that made you fall in love with music? There a piece of music that captured your attention, perhaps?
I remember going to a school concert when I was about 7, 8, something like that, and hearing one of the kids playing Chopin's Prelude in E minor. You know, the one that's very, it's actually quite simple. Da, da, da. It's very simple. It's got these chords in the left hand and the melody in the right hand. And it wasn't played terribly well by this, as you never do when you're a child, but it's one of those pieces that you learn, you know, when you're learning the repertoire, because it is simple. But it's got some lovely chord changes and beautiful harmonies. And I did hear that and thinking, wow, that's just gorgeous. Even though it wasn't played very well, I could hear the harmony changing and how beautiful it sounded when that harmony developed and changed. And then when I learned the piano and started to learn from about 8, I got to that piece eventually and started to learn it, and loved it again at that point. And it is, you know, anyway, Chopin, you know, for pianists is a wonderful, you know, a huge volume of piano music. Every piece is more beautiful than the last, and there's so much there. So I did play a lot of the preludes and the nocturnes when I was learning, and that piece I remember being one of the first pieces that I just thought was a beautiful piece of classical music. I didn't call it classical, I just called it a lovely piece of music.
Do you ever play for pleasure now? I mean, beyond composing, do you sit and ever play?
I mean, I see music as pleasure anyway, from start to finish. Sure. And my writing is pleasure, and working at the piano is pleasure. So everything I write and everything that I do around music, I don't really see it as anything. I don't really see it as work, to be honest. It is a pleasurable experience. So my work is happily what I enjoy doing. I don't think I ever sit down and think, oh, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to take out, you know, a Mozart sonatina that I haven't played for years and play that for pleasure. because I'm always working alongside music. I'm either writing or working on orchestration, or I'm in the studio recording. So I have it in my life always. And therefore, it doesn't feel like I need to sit down and play something just for pleasure. So it's not quite the same.
And tell me a little bit about conducting, because you conduct as well. Was that something that just came with sort of as part of the job, or is it something you pursued and wanted to sort of, you know, be good at and want to learn how to do?
I realised when I started to compose scores for TV that there was never going to be a budget that would cover at the very beginning, you know, tiny, tiny little budgets for composing for documentaries and small dramas, which I did when I started out. I realised that there was never going to be a budget to hire a conductor. So I better learn how to do it. And I did have a couple of conducting lessons at Guildhall School of Music and Drama, where I trained, but they were very kind of just, you know, supplementing the whole composition course. It wasn't a conducting course, but I did have some lessons, which I really, really enjoyed. And I knew the basics, to be honest. You know, I knew how to conduct, you know, in 4, in 3, in 6/8, all that. I knew how to do it, but I hadn't done it professionally. So my first score, I went in the studio and I stood up in front of, I think it was about 5 or 6 musicians. It was just a handful of players, and realised that I had to conduct, and I did it on the job. And it's hard because you're working with these professional session musicians, the best in the business generally, and you have to sort of do your job. And at first I was very, very scared about the whole thing. But eventually I realised quite early on that when it's your own music, and this is different to conducting repertoire, if you're conducting a Beethoven symphony or whatever, when it's your own music, nobody can really tell you how it should go except you. So you sort of...
Only you know.
Only you know, because it's come out of your head. And actually musicians are there to help and to interpret the composer's score. And this is what they're trained to do. Now I absolutely love conducting. I love working with musicians. I love that moment of hearing it for the first time, where a fabulous player interprets your score and interprets your music for the first time. It's a magical thing, and I love it. And I wouldn't not do it now unless there was a reason why I couldn't. But I just absolutely love it.
And you talk about conducting, and let's talk about concerts a little bit. Obviously, you've taken part in many memorable concerts yourself. But as a concert goer, I mean, maybe you don't go to so many concerts these days because you're so busy. But do you remember any concerts that stood out for you, maybe when you were at Guildhall, or was there a concert that you thought, wow, that's just the most amazing evening I've ever had?
Well, I remember one recently, and it was a concert last year, actually, at St. John Smith Square in November. And it was a premiere by a wonderful viola player who's also a dear friend of mine called Philip Dukes. And I've worked with Philip many times. He's played on Wolf Hall and The Glorious Garden and the musical Zodiac and all these projects. He's a stunning player. And he was doing a performance with Tasmin Little of Mozart's Sinfonia Concertante, which is for violin and viola. And it was actually Tasmin Little's final performance before she retired.
Of course.
And Philip's a good friend of hers. And they played it to this really moving, very, very memorable performance. The conversation between the two of them musically was absolutely wonderful. They were both at the top of their game. And that was a great concert.
About when you were sort of aspiring to be a composer, was writing for the screen always part of that, or did that happen along the way as well?
I think it was always a part of, yeah, I think I always knew that I wanted to write for pictures. I like the idea of having something to inspire the music. And when you've got a film or a television program, you've got such a gift in front of you because there's a location, there's a story, there's drama, there's characters, and a kind of in immediate inspiration, which as a composer you can tap into, and it helps inspire the music. I also like the collaboration with the director. You get feedback immediately. You can enjoy trying things out together and going on the journey of the music together, which is lovely. And actually, my composition teacher was Buxton Orr, and he'd written for films in his career, particularly horror films. He was quite well known for writing horror films. So he didn't discourage it, even though at the time when I was at music college, I was asked and expected to write perhaps more avant-garde music for the concert hall. Buxton didn't discourage anything. He didn't care whether it was a song or a piece for string quartet or something that might be suitable for a film or television theme. He was open to all music, and that was hugely valuable.
And when you're working on something which is an ongoing series, like Father Brown, which you have like 90 episodes or something you've done now.
I know, it would have been 100 had we not gone into lockdown this year.
Wow.
Yeah, we would have reached the 100th episode, which would have been just amazing.
Gosh.
I know.
Is that the longest series you've worked
definitely.
On?
Definitely. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and how do you keep that inspiration up if it's, you know, it's sort of like Columbo. It's like the same sort of setup, sort of week after week, same characters, maybe obviously the odd guest character.
Well, the great thing about Father Brown is, although there are key themes for the characters, we've got his sleuthing theme, we've got a theme for Lady Felicia and Mrs. McCarthy and the key characters. There's a theme for Sid. Each episode, there is a new story, a new cast, a new murder. So it's the most dangerous place to live in the whole of the world is Kembleford. If you go to Kembleford and see Father Brown, get out quick because there's bound to be a murder. But, you know that there's going to be something. And every story is different. You know, one might be set in a house, a haunted house, or one might be set in a fairground, or, they have different locations. So there's always something new to inspire the music. And it's just the greatest fun, that series. I was really missing it this year because, 10 episodes fly at me in quick succession, usually from about May onwards. And of course, they couldn't shoot this year. So it was really, I really missed it this year. It's the most brilliant thing to write for. I absolutely love it.
And when you're approaching the first episode of a new series, do you have to sort of get in the Father Brown zone? Do you have to sort of put it on like a costume?
Exactly. Yes, I put on my hat and my gown just like he does. But no, you do have to get into the Father Brown spirit. I have my themes. I've got the main themes for the characters, so all that's there, and that's very useful. But they twist and they turn and they adapt through each other. Every episode is written from scratch, brand new music for each episode. There's no, some people often ask me about this series. I think because there have been so many episodes, is it a library of music? No, it's not. Every episode is scored to picture.
And does it take over? Are you constantly thinking, is that little theme running through your head for like, 2 or 3 months?
Probably, yeah, absolutely. But it does, the great thing is, although it is a long-running series and I have written a lot of episodes, I never get tired of it because every episode there's something new.
So a theme like that is, and music that you're working with regularly is sort of music that you sort of have no choice but to live with. Is there any music that you can't live without, that you have to go to for any reason? Is there a piece that you always turn to for, to cheer you up, for solace, for any reason?
Well, this will probably surprise you because it's nothing like the music that I write, and a composer that you probably wouldn't think I would absolutely love based on the style of my music, but it's actually Olivier Messiaen. And when I was at college, I was encouraged to write quite avant-garde music, and I really couldn't because I loved melody and I wanted to write tunes and all that sort of lovely, lush stuff. But I was encouraged to write avant-garde music. And my brother brought home Messiaen's Tarangalila Symphony. And I don't know where he got it, but he just thought I might like it and listen to it. And I put it on, and this wonderful, colourful music just completely took over my whole life for about, 2 or 3 weeks. I couldn't get it out of my head. I thought, this is wonderful music. It was like nothing I had ever heard. And as well as being great music, it was avant-garde, but it also painted pictures. I could draw pictures with it, which I couldn't do with other contemporary music that I'd been listening to at the time, 12-note stuff, which was quite technically brilliant, but it didn't touch me in the same way as Olivier Messiaen's music did. And occasionally, for me now, I do go to the Tarangalila Symphony. I listen to sections of it. And because of the colour and the just the magic of it, and from the first note of any, actually any Messiaen piece, you know it's him. He has a unique sound, a unique quality to the sound, and draws pictures. And they're different pictures to anything else that you would experience with any other composer. And I think that's a great gift. So I have to say Messiaen. And actually, when I did Desert Island Discs, I chose him. I chose that piece as the piece that I would save because, you know, because it sort of saved me in a way. It saved me from not knowing how to spend my 3 years at music college and how to write music that could draw pictures in an avant-garde way, in a new way. And it sort of, it taught me how to do that. Not that I wrote in that style, but it showed me a way of creating music that could paint pictures, even if it wasn't with a melody.
Are there things that you are longing to do? Are there works under the surface that are just screaming to get at if only you were given the opportunity?
I don't have a massive desire to do one particular thing. I just have a massive desire to keep writing music. And as long as I can keep doing that and keep being productive and keep writing music that hopefully musicians will enjoy playing, then I'm happy. I'm happy doing that. I don't have a great desire to write a grand opera or anything like that, if that's what you mean. But I do have a great desire to keep writing music. I've got a new film called To Olivia, which was a wonderful, wonderful film, which we recorded just after the lockdown restrictions eased for the first time. And it stars Hugh Bonneville as Roald Dahl. It's a film about Roald Dahl and his marriage to Patricia Neal. Keely Hawes plays Patricia Neal. And it's directed by a great collaborator and friend of mine called John Hay. And that's coming out in February. I'm really looking forward to that. We're just putting together the soundtrack album for that. So I'm really looking forward to that being released. It's a really touching, beautiful film. I've just written a piece for the wonderful cellist Stephen Isselis, and he's performed it with his pianist, Mishka Rushdie-Moman. And I was so thrilled to write for Stephen. I've been a huge fan of his for ages and ages, as long as I can remember, actually. And the piece is going to be premiered next year on Classic FM, start of the new year. And the piece is called A Luster to This Day. And it's to sort of start the new year with hopefully in a better way than we've had this year. And that was a great thrill to write for musicians that I admire and love. I've worked a lot with the National Symphony Orchestra over the past few years, as you know. And that's been great because they're all great friends and great musicians. And if I can continue and write music for people that I love working with, that play beautifully, then that's fine. That'll keep me happy.
The official last question for Music to My Ears podcast is what's your current musical obsession? But that may be difficult if you're in the midst of working. Maybe you're not ever listening to other things.
I tend not to listen to other things. And I don't really, obsession is quite a strong word. I have, I do like, in the same way as I like going to concerts of friends and feeling their nerves and watching them play, I also quite like listening to music of friends, other composers that are friends. And my dear friend Joseph Horowitz's music, I find absolutely wonderful and delightful and inspiring. And I've been listening to his oboe concerto, and the slow movement is exquisite. It's absolutely exquisite. I mean, I love the whole piece, but the slow movement's exquisite. And the performance is beautiful on the CD as well. I enjoyed his Captain Noah, which was recently played again on Radio 3. And I think there's something rather lovely about listening to your friends' music and enjoying it and being able to say to them, I listened to that this morning. I really loved it. And I always love it when I hear from other composers and feedback on my music. There's something very special about that because you know, they feel your pain, you know, and there's something that's quite, it's same with musicians. You know, you sort of, there's an understanding of what it takes to be a musician and the dedication, certainly as a performer, that you know, the years of practice, the years of dedication from a very young age to deliver a performance, you know, like Philip Jukes and Tasman Little did at the St. John Smith Square concert. They delivered a performance. And that performance, to be able to deliver that, doesn't happen overnight. It takes years and years and years of dedication and practice, perfecting that skill. And musicians have this sort of unspoken understanding of that. And it is an understanding because you know that there's a hell of a lot of heartache and pain and it, you know, a lifetime isn't long enough to learn a musical instrument, to be a great composer. It just isn't long enough. You know, you have to cram it in as much as you can in your most productive years. And so I enjoy that. I enjoy working with wonderful people and working with friends and listening to friends' music as well.
Learning, I guess, as a musician.
Completely. I mean, you never stop learning. And I think it's a huge learning curve. Every project, I start from scratch and think, oh, gosh, am I going to be able to get this right? I mean, in the genre...
The blank page,
exactly. I mean, you know that as a writer yourself as well. You know the feeling of a blank page. And, you know, I with the John Hay film, with To Olivia... finding that theme for Olivia took a long time. And I was watching the film over and over again and loving it. And I played John two or three themes and I just knew they weren't right. And he would very patiently sit with me and say, oh, I'm not sure, you know, I don't, or, you know, there would be this kind of hesitation. And then one night after talking to him about a particular style and working with him again, I sat at the piano and came up with something that I just knew instinctively was there. You know, I felt it could be the Olivia theme, but until I played it to him, I wasn't sure. So I rung him up. It was quite late, actually. and it was probably way past his bedtime. And I rang him up and said, what do you think? I played it to him down the phone on the piano. And I just knew by his instant positive response that he liked it and it was going to work. And that was the key to it. And then from that moment, I was able to write the rest of the score. But it was getting that thumbs up from John and knowing that we cracked the theme that unlocked the rest of the score. But it didn't happen overnight. You know, it took a long time to come up with that tune. And even though the film spoke to me directly and I loved it, for some reason, it took longer than normal to come up with that theme. But when I got it, it then just flew.
You often don't have the beauty of time, though, do you? So you haven't got time to really get it as right as you'd like sometimes.
That's
maybe
true.
If you're working to a very tight deadline.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes the tight deadline works because you're forced into getting the adrenaline rush and getting it down. And that can work. And I've done that a few times over the years, had to deliver. And sometimes that can work. What happened with To Olivia was actually we were due to record just at the start of the lockdown. And we had booked Air Studios in London to record, and we booked a lovely 50-piece orchestra. And then lockdown hit, and we couldn't. So we cancelled it, and actually the producer was the first to say, no, we must wait until it's safe to record. So we cancelled everything. The studios all closed, as you know. Yeah. And we thought, in hindsight, very naively, oh, it'll be fine, you know, in 6 weeks' time we'll be back. Let's book it in 6 weeks' time and we'll be fine, you know, it'll all be over. Yeah. So we booked for 6 weeks down the down the track. And then, of course, it wasn't fine. And we had to work out a way of doing it. And we managed to get... We were one of the first orchestras back in the studio straight after the lockdown restrictions eased. We got back in the studio, but we had to record over a period of 2 days in smaller groups. We had the brass separately and the strings. Everybody sort of separated off behind screens. It was quite different. It's quite a different way of recording. And also the strings, instead of, as you know, they usually share a stand. Every player had their own stand and everybody had to be 2 meters apart. So all the string players were 2 meters apart all the way around them, not just, you know, just in front, but all the way around 2 meters separate. Double the amount of music copying, you know, because all the music had to be copied.
Yeah, gosh. You don't think about things like that.
But of course, there's a practical side of it. Was quite dramatic. But the great news is that it sounded as good, if not better, than normal. Because interestingly, and I spoke to Justin Pearson, who's a wonderful cellist who booked all the musicians for the National Symphony Orchestra and also played principal cello on the score. Everybody stepped up as a soloist, and there was something about everybody having their own stand. And this is me, you know, I've got my own stand. I don't have to share with anyone else. And everybody stepped up as a soloist. It was remarkable. And it sounded glorious. And I'm so proud of this score.
Well, Debbie, thank you so much for spending some time with us this evening.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Really great to hear about your work and your music, and we look forward to hearing what's in store for you in 2021.
Thanks, Mike.
That was composer Debbie Wiseman on life as a film and TV composer. Her score for Two Olivia is scheduled for release by Decca alongside the film in February 2021. Thank you so much for listening. We hope you've enjoyed this podcast from the team at BBC Music Magazine. Do let us know what you think by rating and reviewing it wherever you've been listening. If you want to find out more about BBC Music Magazine, we're available in print and various digital formats across the world, or you can visit our website, classical-music.com, where you can read all the latest music happenings, read thousands of reviews, and a good deal more. Thank you to Acast for hosting this podcast and to our producer, Jack Bateman.